The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, what a weekend it was in J1. Unfortunately, though, I don't think we'll have much time to go through it all on this week's pod.
No, not really. I mean, only really Tokyo and Hiroshima got the message that said, no, nothing to happen in these games this weekend. It was a really exciting weekend on the pitch, but yeah, far more important stuff going on off it.
Yes, that's because one of the biggest stories, although I guess it's still at the rumour stage as we record on Monday night, in recent J-League history broke on Saturday morning with UK bookmakers installing current Yokohama F. Marinos manager Ange Postecoglou as the short-priced favourite to take over at Scottish Giants Celtic. And joining us to talk about the reaction to the rumour from both sets of supporters and what it might mean for both clubs should it go ahead is a man with a foot in both camps, Sean Galbraith. It's been a whirlwind few days for you, I'm sure, but welcome back to J-Talk and how are you?
Yeah, good to be back on, Ben. It's a surreal situation. Yeah, I mean, who could have thought, right? The first time I came to Japan, came to a Marinos game, was to see Shinsuke Nakamura, of course, right, from Celtic. And for it to kind of come full circle again, and the Marinos manager possibly gone back to Celtic, and it's bizarre, right? Who would have thought it happened?
Yeah, absolutely remarkable. So veteran J-Talk listeners, I'm sure will remember Sean. He was our Yokohama F. Marinos correspondent for a while there. Of course, Stuart Woodward has done a great job in that role in the past couple of seasons. But yes, Sean is a Celtic supporter, first and foremost, before he came to Japan, and since arriving on these shores has become a dyed-in-the-wool Yokohama F. Marinos supporter. So, Sean, I guess firstly, putting your Celtic supporting hat on, you would have obviously been keeping an eye on the rumours over who would be taking over at Celtic Park, with Eddie Howe seemingly set for the role for so long. So then what was your reaction when you first heard that Ange was the front runner on a Saturday morning?
Well, first of all, it was shock. I mean, I thought this was one of those rumours that it's just a rumour, right? It's not going to build any steam, right? They're just picking names out of a hat. And obviously the Eddie Howe negotiations went on for far too long. They went on for 6 months or something like that, right? And Celtic are just waiting for this guy to say yes. And everyone assumed he would, and it was just a matter of time. He was just waiting for his backroom staff. But now it collapsed at the last minute, and Celtic are left without a manager, and they're looking for one. And then within 24 hours of that announcement, then Ange Postecoglou, he'll be the manager. That comes out of nowhere. Honestly, I couldn't believe it at first. It wasn't even something I'd considered.
Yeah, how have Celtic got into this situation whereby they are looking to approach an Ange Postecoglou? What has the season been like, and how has the kind of managerial hunt kind of led us to this point?
Well, I mean, it's been... Oh, yeah, if you taking it back to the 10 years back, I mean, Rangers, paraphrase Kevin Bridges, the comedian, Celtic... Scottish football, famously, a two-horse race lost one of the horses, right? And Rangers were liquidated, and Celtic had free reign at the league for 9 years. And that was the idea, that Celtic would win 9 in a row, win 10 in a row. The maximum that any Scottish club has ever won has been 9 in a row. Celtic did it in the 70s, and Rangers did it in the 90s, and the idea was to beat that. So that's always the manager's job. In Scotland, just to win the league. I mean, it's either your first or your last, right? And it was going well, right? Celtic had eight leagues in a row and on to the ninth. During the eighth league, Brendan Rodgers, who he won the treble twice in a row, the second of which it was an invincible treble. Won, didn't lose any games in the league, didn't lose any games in the cup. And he left... went to Leicester. Neil Lennon comes in to Celtic, who's a former club captain and former manager also. And it's not quite what the Celtic support want. It's not as big a name as Brendan Rodgers. Brendan Rodgers nearly won the league with Liverpool, the English Premier League with Liverpool, and brought Swansea to the Premiership. Neil Lennon, he was big in Scotland, but he's not a big manager. And the team got sort of worse and worse. And in the ninth season, the Celtic should have won. Celtic won nine in a row. It wasn't a comfortable one. Rangers were top of the league at winter. And then in the 10th season, when Celtic should be winning 10 in a row, this historic achievement, it all fell apart. Rangers won the league very comfortably, the 20-point gap, and unbeaten Steven Gerrard, manager there, and Neil Lennon leaves just after the winter break, and Celtic are looking for a new manager. And the kind of names that are being touted are like Rafa Benitez, Andres Villas-Boas, right? So Celtic fans are thinking, we made a mistake here, stepping down from Brendan Rodgers to Neil Lennon. We want to go back to a big name, someone who can bring players and motivate them. And yeah, names like Rafa Benitez, Villas-Boas, or the kind of up-and-coming coaches like Jesse Mensch or Enzo Marasca, who's at Parma now, I think. Jose Bolera's got a job at Valencia. And then they settle on Eddie Howe. Eddie Howe is... He took Bournemouth from the English second, the fourth tier of England, right? League Two.
Yeah.
All the way up to the Premiership and kept them there. And he won the English manager of the decade or stuff like that. So this is the caliber of manager Celtic are looking for. And they were going for Eddie Howe. And Eddie Howe says he doesn't want to take the job until the end of the summer. He wants to consider his options. But it seems like a pretty much done deal. He just wants to sort out his backroom staff, what kind of players he'll get in. And so Celtic wait and say, okay, right, in the summer, we'll get Eddie Howe. And everyone's kind of excited. They're watching YouTube videos of Eddie Howe. And it comes to this weekend, and he says no. And it's panic stations. What do we do, right? This was not the plan. Who do we get? Enzo Marasca, we were contacting. He's got a job. Jose Bolaños, he's got another job. So where do we go? And then Ange Postecoglou's name comes out of nowhere. And understandably, most Celtic fans are like, Who is this? And then they Google him, and they see it was a manager in the J League, and just not having the context. If you look at the kind of stats, right, he won the league, and it's amazing. People don't realize how much of an achievement that is. But you look at that, and you see the season before, he almost got relegated. Last season, we finished mid table, and well, this season's doing well, right, third now, but. It wasn't the Rafa Benitez, the Villas-Boas that people were thinking of. But it's an astute kind of outside the left field choice from the board, maybe through a connection. The CEO of Celtic, of course, is a scout at Manchester City. So there's the connection there. The former manager, Ronnie Dyla at Celtic, is the manager of New York City, Citigroup's MLS franchise. So maybe I threw a connection there, and possibly the incoming director of football at Celtic, Fergal Harkin, is the current under-23 coach in Man City. So probably through that connection, someone knows Ange and suggested him to the Celtic board, and they looked at him and thought, this could be smart, right? We wouldn't have to pay as much as a Rafa Benitez, but this guy could be the next Pep Guardiola, right? Look at his teams. He plays the kind of attacking football that Celtic want to play. He's good at motivating coaches, motivating players. Probably doesn't need a big budget. He can do it with the players he's got. He just needs to change the style. And we need to give him time to do it. But that is the issue, right? Does he get the time?
So, yeah, obviously we're going to have plenty of time and a lot of questions from our patrons on what happens at Yokohama F. Marinos if Ange does go. But again, with your Celtic hat still on, Sean, how do you feel about the situation and how would you feel as a Celtic fan if Postecoglou was given the job? You think he would be up to it, and you think, well, even though he might be fourth or fifth in line, if he is given the job, he would be a success in it?
I mean, on paper, he's an ideal match for what Celtic fans want, which is entertaining, attacking football. I mean, that's the kind of... Going back through the past, the famous Rangers players are all defenders, and Rangers have a good defensive record, and all the famous Celtic players are strikers. They've scored hundreds of goals. And that's the kind of... That's what Celtic fans expect. Even in when Shinsuke Nakamura was in playing at Celtic, and Gordon Strachan was the manager at the time, Celtic qualified for the last 16 of the Champions League, but... There was a lot of criticism about the way they played. A lot of games they won 1-0. It was very kind of slow, meandering football, like kind of defensive, dig in, don't lose any goals. And even though they're qualifying for the last 16 in the Champions League, which is an incredible achievement, people were unhappy because that's not what they wanted to see Celtic doing. They wanted to see Celtic playing attacking football. But not to a fault, right? I mean, you don't want the situation where you get the first season of Andrea at Mariners where you see 4-4 and stuff like that. And I mean, you're neutral, it's brilliant, right? But Celtic can't be losing games. They need to win every game if you want to beat Rangers. Rangers were unbeaten last season. They can do it again next season. So Celtic need to win every game. That's got to be the way forward. And you don't get time to lose matches. You start, especially Celtic, the season starts very early. You start in July in the Champions League qualifiers, and that could be the biggest part of the season. If you get knocked out there, then there's no Europe for you, and it's going to be a very long season until you get another chance. So Danji, you'll have to hit the ground running, and not a lot of Celtic managers do it in their first season, qualify for Europe. It's not an easy task to come in.
Yeah, so we did get a lot of questions, as Ben mentioned, from Patreon. One is from Kenji, who asks, do you think that Celtic have the players ready to perform Ange Postecoglou's style, or does he have to go in and make changes in the transfer window? Has he got a really busy period just to get the team ready to hit the ground running, as you say? Because, yeah, at Celtic, you can't do anything other than that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a brilliant question, because it's difficult to say. In fact, I think it was Ryan McGowan, the former Australia international, he played in Scotland for quite a long time, who said that Ange's squads, they do have some trouble adapting, but he felt that Celtic has probably the highest quality of player, certainly the largest budget of any team that Ange will have managed so far. So he expects the players there would be able to adapt more quickly than his previous teams. So, I mean, that's an interesting viewpoint as well, and I do think Celtic have got a lot of good quality players, but also this is a season of kind of rebuilding. In fact, maybe like 7-8 Celtic first team players are out of contract this season, or they're on loan and they'll go back to their parent club. So it's a rebuilding effort, and not just Ange will come in, but a director of football is the idea to bring in and build this kind of style at Celtic. So probably there'll be players there that he can adapt, but I think they'll bring in players who will suit his style, I think. Which is probably good for him, right? But bringing in new players is always a gamble. You don't know how they're going to be. But at least if he wants to build a team there, which is a good opportunity, you rarely get. In Japan, when he came here, it's kind of, you almost had to take what he got, and it didn't work a lot of the time for the first season. And changing players, getting new players in, made that better. But from Celtic, maybe from the start, he'll get a pick of some of the type of players that he wants.
All right, well, yeah, thanks for that, Kenji. And Kenji goes on to say that, yeah, as an F Marino supporter himself, he doesn't want to see Ange leave at this time of the season. But if he decides to move on, that he would respect and support his decision. Mixed emotions, yes, most definitely, Kenji. And, yeah, thanks for that answer, Sean. So there were other, Celtic-related questions. Another F Marinos supporter, Khalil, who I say is F Marinos, he's basically an Ange supporter, as he says himself. He's a self-confessed Ange obsessive, and he also wonders about the size of the rebuild job at Celtic for Ange if he does take over. Sean mentions that, I'm sure you don't need any reminding, that they lost the league by 25 points last season. And also, Khalil asks, what Japanese players would Ange take with him? And I guess this is kind of related to some of the Celtic fan reaction of Ange himself and the leagues that he's managed in before, but also, yeah, the quality of those leagues as Celtic fans see in relation to their own league. So if you could, firstly talk about, what Khalil's asked there, but also if it's right to compare leagues like these, which have obviously, different styles of football and different focuses, but, what comparisons can you draw? And in other ways, how vastly different are the competition between, the J-League and the Scottish Premiership?
Yeah, a lot of really good questions there. So, I think first on the rebuilding point and the players at Celtic. I think first we've got to say that Ange is an amazing coach, right? He'll get things out of players that other coaches want. He'll I mean, it'll give them a chance to play this new style of football. And if they can adapt to it, then he's happy to include them in the team. And if not, then no. I mean, it's his way or the highway, right? It's the kind of the way he thinks about it, right? So you adapt to his style of play or you're out. And I'm sure that there's a lot of players at Celtic that will relish that. I mean, it's hard to... I mean, you talk about, Celtic lost the league by 20-odd points, but it's almost the exact same squad that won the league, that won the treble the year before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what changed in that time, right? And if it's the same players and something's gone very wrong, then you kind of point the finger at the manager, right, and the coaching and what's gone wrong there. So even without changing the players, you think Ange could get something interesting and different out of them, plus one or two of his own players. So going on to, would he take any of the J League players over? I mean, I'd like him to. That's personally, I think if he could get a player like Thiago Martins, for example, who kind of epitomises the style that he plays, right? Where, from the back, kind of cool, calm, collected, fast defender. So he needs to be high up the pitch. He needs to cover the space behind him if Mariners are counter-attacked. So someone who can run like that, at Celtic maybe they don't have so many defenders, centre-halves who run at that speed. I think a player like that, that a kind of ball-playing player and not a traditionally ball-playing position like centre-half. Goalkeeper, there's not one you could take from Mariners, I think, so we'll have to look elsewhere for that. But the other thing that kind of epitomises the style that Andy's playing is running, right? And kind of the pacey, the wingers and the forwards that come in. So if I could pick, I'd take Maida, Dyson Maida. But would he adapt to the kind of style of play in Scotland? I mean, it's a lot more physical. And a lot, that's kind of the what people say, right, with Japanese players in Scotland and England match up to the kind of the more there's hammer throws basically in other teams, right? He'll just kick you and not give you the time to pick a pass. So it doesn't matter how technically gifted you are. If you can't outwit them, then you're on to nothing. But I mean, Nakamura did it. It's rare, but there's plenty of Japanese players who've done it. He's still young, he's a talent. I think he wouldn't cost that much money, so I'd take him. Last one, you need creative players, right? So it's Marcos Jr. He's a player that, he's playing a floating role right now, number 10, and he's kind of given that free role because Andy trusts him to do something when it needs to be done. And those are the kind of players you need, right? Because at Celtic, even more than the current league he's playing in now, the teams out with Rangers will play with basically 11 men behind the ball. So the game that Mariners played against Oita last week, it was, I don't know if any of you watched it, it was not a good game to watch. It was... you're right, I mean, there's no chances. It was part of the bus time, right? And you can't blame teams for playing like that because that exploits Mariners' weakness, that if you don't let them get space and play and counter and be pacey, and you just close, make them tight and hard to break into, then they just pass the ball around you. And you need a creative player to unlock that. And that's the problem Celtic might have if they play a new style of football where every team in the league is going to play like that against them. So they need players who can just make a bit of magic, lose a man, take a man on themselves, and get into that space. But there's players at Celtic that can do that, and there's players that can bring in. But Marcos Jr., I'd take him.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, it's rare, right, that Ange actually takes players with him, I think, isn't it? I mean, when he came to Mariners, didn't bring anyone with him, as far as I'm aware. There was who was the Australian player in the league that was playing in...
Did he bring Milos Deganek? Was that a Postecoglou sign-in?
No, in fact, he was there before Ange came. Yeah, yeah, so... There was, I think he didn't bring anyone himself. And, I mean, that kind of speaks to how well he operates under a system of like a director of football or something, which he might have at Celtic. So, he was a coach, first and foremost. And with the resources he's given, he'll get the best out of them. So he might not have the choice to bring players with him, but regardless, I'm sure he'll do well. So the other point was about the leagues, right? Comparing the leagues and what kind of differences there are, right?
That's right.
And yeah, so there's, I mean, a lot of hypocrisy, right? I think from Celtic fans, especially. I mean, it's like we spoke about earlier. It's easy to see why people are upset when they were expecting something very different from what they're probably going to get. But you say, oh, he's not managing Europe. He's not a big name. Well, I mean, how hard is it to win the Japanese League or the Australian League? How hard is it to qualify for the World Cup with Australia? Right. And you say that while your team plays in the Scottish Premiership, right? It's the height of irony, right? And I mean, these people rightfully will tell you how entertaining, how good Scottish football is, actually, if you go to the games. And it's not a kind of plastic kind of product like a lot of leagues are these days. There's a lot of kind of passionate supporters and people who support a team who have no chance of winning the league, but they have that kind of loyalty. And there's a lot of good atmosphere, there's a lot of good derbies, and it's just a brilliant league to watch. Much like in Japan, it's a difficult league to win, much like in Japan. I don't know about Australian football, but can anybody walk in and win the league, Ben?
Oh, I don't know, mate. Yeah, no, I wouldn't have thought so.
No, exactly, right. I mean, if you could, then I'll be on the plane next, right? I'll be I'll be lifting the trophy, right? But, I mean, it's not easy. It's not an easy thing to do to win any of these leagues. It's not an easy thing to do to qualify for a World Cup. So, I mean, the amount of these being talked down is ridiculous, to be honest. But it's what happens, I think, in football, especially in Europe, when people are kind of short-sighted about anything outside of England, France, Italy, Germany, Spain. And it's unfortunate because there's a lot of good players, a lot of good managers outside that they'd find if they looked a bit further. However, the leagues are very different in playstyle, like I was saying earlier. And if you watch 5-minute clips of each, you'll see that in Japan, you've got a lot more time to pick a pass. There's a lot more space. The pitches are bigger, usually. And if you watch Scottish football, then you'll see that players are closed down very quickly. Or if you're passing out from the back and you're a team like Celtic, while you're slowly passing out from the back, the other team will get every single one of their men back in their box. And then you've got no chance. So, yeah, it's a very different style of football, and he'll have to adapt to that. But, like, I'm sure Australia was very different. International football was very different. Japan was very different. You have to adapt to different styles. And I've got no doubt that he'll do it, but he can't play the same way he plays here. And he'll need to find some way to do it. And that's the worry, isn't it? That Angie says he believes in his way of playing football. He won't change it for anyone. And if it isn't working, if he isn't unlocking these teams that have packed defences, and he says, no, I'm not changing it, and the fans get on his back, then how long does that last?
Indeed. All right. Well, yeah, following on from that answer, that was very good that you mentioned that right there towards the end there, Sean, because there was another question from Daniel, who is a Nagasaki fan, first and foremost, who follows the J1 only casually, but is a Celtic supporter. He's a favourite team in the European leagues, are Celtic. And Daniel says, yeah, from what he's seen, Marinos are always running and able to score goals, but how have they been doing against teams that put 11 men behind the ball for 90 minutes and have to be picked apart? And he says, as you just referenced, because that is what Celtic have to deal with most of the time. So, yeah, the Oita game recently is probably not the best advertisement, I suppose, for Ange Ball, isn't it? They weren't able to find a way through until very late on. But, I guess Daniel is wondering whether, Ange's system in games like the Oita one is flexible enough to deal with such a rigid defensive opponent, as that's what he's likely to face if he does stump up at Celtic.
It's not designed to. The only substitutions Angie makes are to get fresh legs. If you notice, every single game around the 70th minute, you'll swap three players for like players, and it's not I mean, very rarely he'll change the shape a little bit, or he'll swap a player to the other side, or he'll maybe put an extra player in the middle. But I mean, it's not massive changes to the style of play, and that's what he says. You know, you just have to keep believing that if we keep playing our football, we'll get a goal. And at this point, basically what he's saying is he believes in the players, they'll be able to make something happen if they keep trying. And at that point, you need a creative player. You need something like June Amino has done it a few times this season, to just out of nowhere, your left foot, and pick a cross right into the exact right spot. Or, you know, even like Thiago Martin is taking shots from outside the goal, something like that. Something that's a bit unexpected. You kind of leave it to the players to do. And at that point, as his fault, a lot of that's up to the players on the pitch. And you need Celtic players with quality. Tom Rogic, actually, still at Celtic, is the kind of player that does that. I don't know if he'll be there much longer. He's been there a long time now. He's getting near retirement or near moving on, I'm sure. But that kind of sort of bit of magic is what you need, and you'll need players like that to step up and believe. And because of the players, they need to buy into it, right? And what happened with Ronnie Dyla, I mentioned earlier, who's the New York City manager now. He had a very similar idea, right? The board kind of, it was almost a mirror situation of Angie, where they wanted to appoint this young new manager. He won the league in Norway with Strømsgodset, who are a kind of mid to low table team, provincial team, and he won the league with them. And he was very highly thought of. He went to Manchester City and he did lectures, and Pep Guardiola liked him. It's a very, very similar situation to what's happening now with Angie. And Ronnie Dyla, for example, he tried to implement a ketogenic diet on the players, so they no carbs, right? And the idea is that you eat fat and you get energy from that, and you can run faster than all the other players. It was this kind of new sports science approach, and the players didn't buy into it. And one of the players at the time, who was a captain for a while, Charlie McGrew, said recently in a podcast he was hiding in the cupboard putting sugar in his tea. And I don't know if you know about ketogenic diets, but I think if you've got sugar in your tea, it's not going to work, right? So he lost the dressing room, Ronnie Dyla, and they didn't get buy-in to his style of play or his ideas. And the players lost belief, and then they don't play well, right? So what Angie needs to do is to keep the players believing, even if the results are not going his way, that if they keep playing his style of football, it'll come. And I mean, that's down to his motivation, right? And if he can motivate the players, and he did it in Marinos, he's done it before, and I've no doubt he can do it at Celtic, but it's not going to be easy.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely the positive you see with Postecoglou. To have come into a Japanese team is going to be very difficult for him to get his message across, but he's managed to get a new Japanese team to completely buy into the way he plays. But my question for you really is, obviously at Celtic, the pressure is going to be immense. What sort of pressure, if any, was he under at Marinos to get results, especially during that first season? Or were the fans quite relaxed with the way that they saw good football being played and they thought, OK, these methods will come good? And then after that, if I could put that to Ben, what sort of pressure did he face as the Australia manager? And can that possibly help him for the kind of intense scrutiny he's going to face managing Celtic?
I think in Japan, maybe the media environment helped him a bit, where they're nowhere near as ruthless as he'll face in Scotland, right? And that's the one thing he's got to be prepared for. Probably maybe similar to what he faced in Australia, I'm sure Ben will tell you. But in Japan, at least, even though the results were, it was going quite badly. And I think speaking to the average supporter, Japanese supporters are very nice, right? Compared to the average supporter, they were willing to give him time. But speaking to the kind of more hardcore Marinos supporters, and on Twitter when people were anonymous, there was like, we need to get Angie, we need a new manager, we can't. Marinos have never been relegated, only one of two teams in J1, they've never been relegated. And we definitely can't get this happen, it's unacceptable. We need to change the manager now, it's too much. And, well, thankfully, the people in charge didn't listen to that, and they gave him the time that he needed. They gave him another season, which was, I was surprised at, to be honest. I wouldn't have, if I was in charge, I would have changed it. So, I mean, they were very patient with him, and they believed in his project, and I'm sure he said from the start it's not going to be easy, and look at the other clubs I've been at, it's the same story the first season, there's growing pains, but give me time. And they did give him time, and it paid off, and it was a brilliant decision. And it's harder to get that in Scotland, because I mean, like we said at the start with Celtic, they need to win every game, but also the media, a foreign coach is an easy target. I mean, especially Angela, I mean, you think he's getting it bad from the fans now, like, that record, his record, and never managing a team in Europe or only managing the Greek third division, that'll be up on in lights if he loses the first few games. And it's like, well, we told you, this guy, he's a nobody. This is what happens when you hire this kind of guy. And if he doesn't have the personality to deal with that, which I think he does, but it's a lot of pressure in Glasgow. Everywhere you go out, it's not a big city. There's only 300,000 people. I mean, it's like a decent mid-sized UK city, right? I mean, not as big as London, but kind of the next step down after that. But everybody knows who you are. Everybody knows the Celtic and Rangers managers. Everybody knows most of the players. If you walk out, the people shout things at you. If it's gone badly, and it's probably the loneliest place to be in the world. Even if it's gone well, then you've got the opposition fans against you. So it's not something you'll ever have dealt with. I think even in Australia, it's crazy. And a lot of people, their families and things like that, they don't like it. And it's a tough environment to be in. You can't disappear and you can't hide from the media. So that, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how he deals with it.
Well, yeah, in terms of the Australian national team, I mean, he'll always have the 2015 Asian Cup, you know, the first time Australia ever won that trophy. And, you know, he's responsible for, bringing in basically a new generation of national team players. There were so many big names in Australian football that had to be phased out. Your Harry Kewells, your Mark Viduka's, et cetera. And, Ange obviously had a thankless task at the World Cup in 2014 when Australia were drawn in the same group as Spain and Holland, let alone Chile. And while obviously heading into that tournament, Ange would have, you know, trusted his players to get results in most of those games. Unfortunately for him and for Australia, yeah, it didn't work out, and Australia lost all three games, but they did earn some plaudits for their performances, and he was able to build on any positives he could take from that competition into the 2015 Asian Cup. So whether it's certainly not the same sort of pressure, I would say, even as a J-League manager, because Australian football, while it's come a long way, it's still, you know, it competes with other sports for headlines, for back pages. So there isn't quite the furnace on the manager, and the same amount of critique and criticism, if results are turning sour. So, again, it's all part of his journey, and you know, he wouldn't be manager of Yokohama F. Mariners, I'm sure, if he hadn't had that stint in charge of Australia. And indeed, the clubs that he managed in the A League was very successful, obviously mostly with Brisbane Roar. So it's all been a stepping stone, and this, if it happens, is a huge next step, but I'm sure one that he feels he's ready for. So, Sean, I'm sure we might have some curious Celtic fans tuning in who maybe have somewhat of an open mind. I think there's probably a few of them out there. Judging from the Twitter replies, it doesn't seem like there's many. But if you were to sell Ange Ball, if you were to sell Ange Postecoglou to a Celtic fan who's listening, who, has managed to keep an open mind in the face of all the criticism about, well, firstly the board and their hunt for a manager, and ultimately ending up, it seems, on Ange Postecoglou. You've lived through Ange Ball for the last 3.5 years, and of course you wouldn't trade the 2019 title for anything. But there's no doubts, and I don't think you'd hide from the fact that 2018 and 2020 were both difficult seasons, weren't they? So I guess if you were to summarise things from a Celtics fan perspective, what do Celtic fans have to look forward to, and ultimately are you in favour of it? Do you want it to happen?
All right, so I think Celtic fans, if you speak to any Celtic fan and you ask them what the greatest achievement in the history of the Celtic Football Club is, they'll speak about 1967, when Celtic won the European Cup. So now the Champions League. With the team, they were nicknamed the Lisbon Lions, right? The final was held in Lisbon. And they were the first British team to win the European Cup. And they did it with players who were all born within, I think, about 10 kilometres of Glasgow, right? So an achievement that will never be done again. But the thing about that team is, what everyone says about them, if you ever speak to any of the opposition players that played against them that time, and they beat Inter Milan in the final 2-1 in Lisbon. Inter Milan were seen as the tacticians of football. They were like the movie stars, and they played the Italian defensive style, and they would never ship any goals. They were impossible to break down, and they just keep possession and play side to side and then get around the players and score a goal, and they'd wear you out. But Celtic in that Celtic team was just all out attack. It was, if you can even go and watch the videos now, and you'll just see the players constantly bombing forward. Every time they've got the ball, every time they don't have the ball, they're pressing forward, pressing players, attacking football. And kind of from that era, the idea that Celtic should be this attacking side was born. And that, like I said earlier, even when Celtic are successful, if they're not playing that attacking football, then fans are upset. And Ange brings that. That's what he's about. He's about playing football with the ball on the ground, playing attacking football, scoring goals, entertaining. And that's his philosophy. It's exactly, it's almost exactly the ideal of what people think Celtic should be. It's crazy that it actually fits so well. And people, they don't believe that he can do it. And he has to prove them wrong. And he's done it before. I mean, he's proved people who doubted him after the first season that Mourinho's wrong. I mean, he's proved it in Australia. And he just has to do it again. And if you trust him, you believe him, and you give him a chance, then you could probably see maybe the most exciting Celtic team in your lifetime.
Wow, that sounds, well, I'm not a Celtic fan myself, but that sounds pretty good to me. I'm ready to run through a brick wall for Ange. So, Sam, what about from a neutral perspective then? It won't have been Saturday morning when you first heard the news, or maybe it was actually, by the time you woke up, it probably was very, very early in your Saturday morning. And what was your reaction? I'm not sure if you'd been across the Celtic managerial merry-go-round or not, but yeah, when you first heard about Ange being in the frame, what was your immediate reaction?
Well, it was definitely a surprise, because I think it was like Friday afternoon here, and Celtic had released a statement saying that Eddie Howe wasn't going to be the manager, and one of my mates just saw the betting odds, and Postecoglou was at 3-1 at the time, and he was asking me, well, who is this guy, what's going on, why is he linked? So it was very much a surprise. I know that Ange has wanted a move to Europe, and that's kind of his eventual aim, but yeah, it still came out of nowhere. But it is excitement for, like, to see if that style of play, if he can put it into Celtic and get it to work, and you might get a bit more backing at Celtic and you'd be a bit more exposure. It could be really good for him, maybe other AFC managers if he does really well. But, I mean, it's going to be really difficult. I mean, I don't see Postecoglou having the first season he did at Marinos and still lasting at Celtic. I think he could probably get, if he started off really poorly, I mean, they could be getting rid of him before Christmas. So I really hope that doesn't happen. I hope that he can implement his style there. And I think what you'll get from anyone that's watched Postecoglou in the J-League is, give him time, the results will come, the style will come, the team will develop. But yeah, it's just hoping that the Celtic fans, the Celtic board, do give him that time. They give him the backing in the transfer window to get the players that he wants in. But yeah, it is really exciting, and I'm so happy for him, because I mean, all of his hard work has come through. I mean, he is, and we've had a few questions kind of what is like the maybe his legacy in the J-League, and I just think kind of the way that he has developed the style of play, a lot of teams have taken on board things that he has implemented in. You see it a lot in the Kawasaki team, and the J-League as a whole has become a better product for having Postecoglou in the league and the kind of developments that he has brought in. So, yeah, really happy for him if this does go through, as it looks like it might do. And, yeah, I wish him all the best. But, yeah, it's such a tough ask. But, yeah, hopefully, yeah, all things go well for him.
Yeah, that's the thing, I guess, isn't it, Sean? It's the furnace, and wondering what sort of a leash he's going to be given if he doesn't hit the ground running in the first month, 6 weeks or so. Casual supporters of Scottish football know. Yeah, to many people, it's a two horse race, as you said yourself earlier, Sean, and with the Rangers returning to prominence, that is now well and truly the case. So, I mean, you know, for Celtic supporters, I mean, let alone third being an option, second isn't even an option, is it? So, yeah, I mean, Sam's right to mention that. And we know what Postecoglou has done for F. Marinos with that title win in 2019. But, again, that first season, when you finished 12th and were, level on points with the team that finished 16th in the promotion relegation playoff, and only, well and truly above them on goal difference, but yeah, the same points tally over the course of a season. And obviously that will not fly at all at Celtic. The expectations are just completely, completely different. And I mean, yeah, you've painted a picture for the Celtic supporters that I hope gets them excited. But I mean, at the same time, you must know yourself that the expectations of this club in this in inverted commas, you know, two team league title race, a slow start, let alone as I said, a 12th place finish isn't even conscionable, is it? But the expectations are just going to be hopefully something that he relishes, but at the same time, he won't have time to settle, will he?
No, you're right, and I think, while I was selling Angie as best as I could there, I probably didn't answer the second part of your question, which was, do I want him to be manager? And what did I think? And to be honest, as soon as the first time I heard the idea that he'd be manager, I think my initial thought, I said it in one of the Mario's group chat, was, I think this might be a disaster. what was running through my mind at that point was the idea of that first season. And Scott Bain, the Celtic goalkeeper, imagine him being on the halfway line and getting chipped from 80 yards. A defensive errors, trying to play it out, pass it out, passing it back to the keeper and passing it into the goal, things like that. Like these, the way, it wasn't just that Ange lost in this first season, it's the way he lost. It was comical at times. And it's because they were trying to adapt to this totally alien style of football to them. And it was taking a long time, but in the media situation in Scotland, I don't know if he'd survive the keeper getting chipped three times. I think at that point, people would say, no, you need to change it. And they wouldn't allow him to continue with it. It would be taken out of his hands, probably. You'd have to be a very brave person in the board at Celtic, I think, to persist to that very stubborn person, to be honest. And hopefully they are, to be honest. But I think it's going to be more difficult to allow for errors like that. And I think Ange did adapt, actually. When people say he doesn't change his style, and to an extent that's true, to most, that's kind of all the way through the team, not much changes from game to game and from when he first came in. But if you look at the position of the keeper, it's changed. When it was Ikra in the first season, you could watch the heat map and he was in the midfield, basically, right? But now, the keeper doesn't come that far out and he's a bit more conservative with what they can do. Pass back, sometimes the keeper will kick it out, get out of danger. And that's something that he's adapted. And I don't think he would admit it, but I think he's compromised on that point. And so it shows that Ange is not 100% so stubborn that he would never change anything. And I think if he saw at Celtic that something wasn't possible, that and if he knew it was going to cost him his job, just not to the extent that it compromises his vision and his style and what he'd do, but I think he would adapt. And so it would be interesting to see if he does anything different than he did at Marinos, considering that the pressure, not that the pressure would get to him, but just if he was aware that, the style of football is different and the way the teams play against him will be different. So I'm sure he'll say he'll play the same way, but if he actually does 100% keep the exact same style, it'll be interesting to see.
All right, and I should say, yeah, obviously, 12th place finished in the Scottish Premier League would put them bottoms, and that's certainly not going to happen to Celtic, and yeah, especially under Ange. So, of course, that's it's all relative, of course, but yeah, in an 18-team J League as it was back in 2018, there were definite teething problems for Ange in his first season. So, I guess, yeah, to try and sum things up from a Celtic perspective before we move on and properly address what might happen at Yokohama F. Marinos. Sean, Tokyo Fox, one of our patrons, in an email full of excellent questions. I mean, basically, Tokyo Fox just wants to know, Sean, yeah, in an ideal world, what do you want to happen? Would you want Ange to stay at Marinos and for Celtic to look elsewhere, or do you see that this is just too good an opportunity for Ange to turn down, if indeed he has been offered the position and has agreed to take it, as has been rumoured in the last couple of days?
Well, I mean, I think from his perspective, he's got to take it, doesn't he? I mean, I think there's a lot of upset people on both sides. I think we talked about the kind of the hypocrisy of some Scottish fans and the kind of knee-jerk reaction of someone they don't know and someone coming from Asia to manage in the Scottish League, as if there's some big step up. It is to some extent, but it's not. He's not coming from a backwater. He's playing very good football in a very entertaining league. To the same extent. Sorry, what was the question?
Well, yeah, what do you want to happen? Do you want him to stay, or you see that it's too good for him to turn down?
Yeah, I mean, you can't turn it down, right? But I think that it's a gamble for him as well, but I mean, it's a gamble that anyone would take, I think. And a lot of the kind of on the other side, people who are reading these comments, Japanese fans and a lot of Australian fans who are reading the Celtic supporters comments, and obviously getting a bit upset that it's seen as a slight at them, right? That their manager or their countrymen are not good enough for the Scottish League, right? Who are you to say that? Celtic's a step down. You should be playing in England or the Bundesliga. It's some of those comments I noticed, right? So a lot of people are heated on both sides, but I think if you think of it kind of calmly, he's done very well in the G League. He's been here 3 years. I think ideally, he would stay until the end of the season and get everyone's best wishes, but they just the unfortunate way that Japan has a summer league and Scotland has a winter league, despite having not the weather for it. it's going to be a clash where if he leaves now, he leaves halfway through the season, right? And that's upsetting to some people, and I'd like him to stay for the full season in Japan, but if he's going to Celtic, he has to go now. They won't wait for him until the winter, so he's only got one chance, and it's unfortunate, but if I was him, I would take it, and I'm sure many people would. It's going to a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, maybe. Who knows if he'll get another chance like that, so I'm sure he will take it. And but it's, yeah, for Marinos to switch hats back to Marinos supporter, it's a disaster. what do we do? I mean, the team's built. It's Ange Postecoglou's team. Marinos football, that phrase, is actually Ange ball, right? So what do you do? Do you get a manager that tries to mimic his style, a kind of protege of his, someone who's an assistant coach now, or a different manager who's similar in style? Or do you go for a completely different style, tear it up and start again? And where does the success that has come until now go? Then, I mean, third in the league, second if you count the games in hand, assuming we don't lose all three of them. If you win one and draw one, I think you're above Grampus in second place. Win all of them, only 3 points, 3 to 6 points, I think, behind Frontale. So you don't want to tear that up and start again. So it's must be a headache for whoever's in charge. What do you do? I don't know. And I don't know who's the best choice to replace him.
Yeah, that's really tricky, isn't it? And well, Sam, yeah, are there any names that come to mind for you? Would the F. Marinos be best served to take one of the branches from the Ange coaching tree and either bring them back and try and keep the same philosophy, or do you see them going for a bigger name, a Japanese coach, who they would hope, I guess, would kind of try to stick to a similar philosophy, but would obviously want to put their own stamp on things. Akakichi no 11 mentions Yahiro Kazuma as a possibility. Obviously, he's been getting lots of mentions on J-Talk in recent weeks with us linking him to both FC Tokyo and Gunma Osaka. As of this recording, obviously, neither of those have happened, so he is he's still out there. Or is there anybody else that you could see that might be able to fill Ange's very big boots?
Well, to be honest, I don't see Kazuma as an option. I just think that maybe, well, CFG obviously have their foot in Marinos. I think they'll have their list of, as we've mentioned before, with how kind of linked everyone is that they go between these clubs. I think they'll probably have a list of potential candidates that would come in and take over full time. But as it's happening right in the middle of the season, and it's such a philosophy with Postecoglou that you don't want to be able to have to go in and tear it up, I think the ideal solution would be to try and get someone who has worked with him. I think maybe a month ago you might have just gone with Pete Klimovsky, but now he's obviously tied up with Montedio Yamagata, and likewise with Arthur Pappas, who went to Kagoshima and has now left to be closer to his family. So the only one left is John Hutchinson, who has had like a kind of roller coaster a few months where he wasn't allowed in to join up with the club right at the start of the year. He's only just got into Japan and cleared quarantine, and now the guy he's come to work under is leaving. So he's had a difficult few months, but maybe if you give it him just for as a caretaker basis just until the end of the season, see how well he does. It's going to be he's not going to change the style too much, you wouldn't imagine. So it might be the least disruptive move to kind of stay with someone like him. But yeah, going on from that, you'd see how that went for the next 6 months to the end of the season. But going from then, I mean, yeah, it's a really difficult decision for him. They'll have to go for someone as close to this, I'd say, because if you go completely the opposite way, in a similar way that when they went from Momberts to Postecoglou, it was such a transformation that they dropped from finishing around 4th, 5th with Momberts down towards a relegation battle. So they don't want to be going for that sort of switch, I wouldn't have thought. So yeah, it'd be someone quite close, but I would imagine it would be an international manager. That just seems to be the way that CFG work. I just don't see a Kazuma or another kind of domestic-based manager.
Yeah, all right. Well, thanks for that, Sam. And yeah, thanks, Kakichino 11, for your question. Charlotte's and Michael's questions were along similar lines about what, who might come in and how that might affect the style of play that, Sean, I'm sure you've obviously become very enamoured with over the last 3.5 seasons. But with your F. Marinos supporters cap firmly on now, before we move back on to other conversations about the impact on F. Marinos as a whole, I think because we've got a couple of questions from our patrons about it, I better ask you about the overall reaction and the vitriol seemingly from the Celtic supporters. I'm not sure if you've had any of your mates from back home texting you wondering who the hell this Postecoglou fella is who manages your club, and whether you've had to assuage them that he's actually a pretty good manager who's most definitely knows what he's on about. So I don't know, I don't want to put any words into your mouth, but how have you felt about the overall reaction of Celtic supporters to this rumoured appointment?
It's unfortunate, yeah. It's understandable to some extent, but it is needlessly negative. A lot of it stems, I think, from the reaction to the board, first and foremost, the Celtic board, and how they let it get to this point where Celtic fans, that they wanted the Rafa Benitez, and then they were sold on, we can't get a manager of that, he's too expensive, he won't come to Celtic, so we'll get this brilliant up-and-coming manager who's proven himself in England, and he's managed in the Premier League, so we'll get him instead. And no, then we lost that as well. And now we're at someone who hasn't managed in Europe, so he's an unknown quantity. He's managed very successfully in other leagues, but not leagues that are known to people in Scotland. And I think a few people, I mean, they don't understand that how competitive J League is, and that you not there's not a, a big two or a big big four even. It's not you're not if you finish fourth one season. There's not a team that finishes fourth every season, right? There's not a Man City, Liverpool, Man United, Chelsea sort of thing in the G League. There, I mean, there's big clubs and there's clubs you would expect to win the league, but Mariners finishing fifth or sixth, it's not unusual. It's not out of the ordinary, and it's not seen as a failure. It's maybe it's not success, but it's not a disaster. But I think a lot of people didn't realise that. They just look at the finishes in the league and they see, oh, he's taken this team that was fourth and he nearly relegated them. But then he won. But then he finished ninth. And it's if you look at the stats in isolation like that, then you can see why people get the kind of the trepidation that they've got and the belief that this is not a good appointment. When you match up against other these other names who've won the Champions League, right? I mean, so it's a different. It's very easy to compare in that sense, and they don't compare. Andy hasn't had those opportunities, hasn't had the chances to do that, but I mean, it's not his fault, but he hasn't. So why are we picking him? Is the kind of the thought behind Celtic fans? And like I said earlier, it is unfortunate the kind of. The tone of some of the right, anybody could win the G League or the league or the A League or anybody can manage Australia to you know they're the fourth best team in the AFC. So I mean someone said to me today in fact I read a comment that Australia winning the AFC the cup is the same as Portugal winning the Euros. It's not that unusual, right? They're one of the biggest teams there. It's not a great achievement. And I think Portugal winning the Euros is a great achievement if they did, and I'm sure people in Portugal would be very, very happy about that, and they would praise the manager for that. But that's the kind of thinking, right? People talking down to other leagues, despite the fact that Scotland has regressed a lot over the last 50 years. Scottish teams now can't match most leagues, never mind England. Probably, 10th? Or lower, probably, in Europe in terms of ranking overall, Celtic and Rangers being the exceptions. But it's a very entertaining league, and it's a hard league to win. And it's weird because you see lots of people saying, we'd rather have Steve Clark, right? Steve Clark currently is the Scotland manager. And what Steve Clark did to get the Scotland job is he's got a very good record, actually, right, in managing, being assistant manager at Chelsea and things like that, managing in England. But then he came to Kilmarnock in Scotland and took a club that was almost relegated, and he finished third, I think, and he qualified for Europe with them and won a trophy, things like that. And they see that and think, we want that manager because we know what Kilmarnock is and we know how hard it is to get third or to get fourth in the Scottish League with Kilmarnock. So it's a known quantity to us. He's a good manager. He knows the league. Get him. But when Angie wins the J League with Marinos, or wins the A League with Brisbane Roar, it's not. They don't see the equivalence there, even though it's the same kind of thing. So it's a bit unfortunate that people are kind of short sighted and don't see his achievements for what they are, which are incredible achievements. I mean, there's four stars on the Marinos shirt now, and one of them was put there by Angie Postecoglou, and no one will ever take that away from him. And I'm sure. No matter what happens at Celtic, they'll always be regarded as a success at Marinos, I think. So, unfortunate, the reaction, but understandable that people are upset at what happened at Celtic. And Ange is the target of that frustration now. And he's fighting an uphill battle from the start. He's got it worse than any other manager probably recently in Celtic's history because he's not starting from zero, he's starting from minus 10. And he's got to work harder than anybody else to win the support. So, yeah, I mean, it's tough for him. And it's not his fault, so it's a shame.
Yeah, what will that support be like? Because Twitter is a kind of a cesspool, and you get the worst of people on Twitter, and it's kind of, you see the worst reactions. But what will it be like for him for his first game at Celtic Park? What will the reaction be like? Will the Celtic fans be on his back straight away, or will they get behind him in that first game? You said it was a bit like Ronnie Dyler's appointment, so I assume there were similar thoughts about him on Twitter at that time. So what was it like with the Celtic fans in the ground and the actual support for the manager?
It'll die down. I mean, he's got time on his hands, thankfully. Well, he doesn't have that much time. The qualifiers start in a month or so. If he starts now, so we'll see how quickly he gets in, assuming he is appointed. But once people are in the gates, people will get behind him, surely. I think people will give him a chance, and hopefully, especially if he hits the ground running, then he'll buy himself a lot of time. If he doesn't, then it might be difficult for him. I think we'll see what happens in Scotland, where, I mean, coronavirus now, right? Still, there's no fans allowed at stadiums. In fact, they're allowing fans back in. So who knows what the capacity will be for these qualifiers. And it won't be a full stadium, I'm sure. So in a way, that actually might help him. If there was a full stadium, Celtic Park, 60,000 fans, you can feel the pressure when things aren't going well. And it feeds onto the players and the manager, I'm sure, as well, when the fans are getting on your back. And in a way, because of coronavirus restrictions, if there aren't a lot of fans there and they can't shout as much as usual, he might have a bit of a break that he might not have otherwise have. It might help a bit. But the reaction online, even, Twitter's bad, but I've looked at some forums. For example, Kerrydale Street is the kind of most posh Celtic forum. It's a bit more the kind of thinking man's Celtic forum. And even there, the reaction is overwhelmingly negative, I think. Maybe 90-95% people are not happy with the appointment. But there's the 5-10% who are giving him a chance and are very passionate about this. Might be a good idea. This might work out really well. And it's a minority right now. So hopefully that minority, after people calm down and they realise that as much as they shout, they're not going to probably change this decision. It's probably been made. If it is, and if Andrew is the manager, then they will get behind him, I think. And if he starts delivering this kind of football, then he'll win people on board. But yeah, he has to do it by himself. He doesn't have the benefit of Brendan Rodgers coming in and saying, he's from Northern Ireland, from a Celtic supporting area in Northern Ireland, and his family were all Celtic fans, and it was his dream. Which are all lies, by the way. Brendan Rodgers is a bit of a narcissist, but it wasn't lies that he was born there and his family were Celtic fans. But if you're a Celtic fan, would you leave halfway through the season to go to Leicester? That is debatable. But I think Ange doesn't have that. He doesn't have the goodwill, unfortunately, that even Ronnie Dyla maybe had. Ronnie Dyla came in when Rangers weren't in the league. And so he had the chance of the board. They had the room to take the gamble. And now, do they have the room to take this gamble on Ange, which they're doing? It's debatable. Celtic lost the league. They're now not going for the 10 in a row anymore. That's gone. So maybe there's not that pressure to continue to win. But this might be the biggest league campaign in Scotland for a long time, because since Rangers came back and Celtic, their performances in Europe collectively have won back an automatic Champions League group stage space for the champion of Scotland next year. So whoever wins the league in Scotland this year automatically qualifies for the Champions League group stage. And that is a massive prize. That is upwards of £25 million just for the TV fees, and then plus all the rest that comes with it. And the amount of players you can attract saying you'll play Champions League football. So it might be a bit of a winner takes all year. And at that point, do you want to be taking a gamble on your manager, which is what they've done? We'll see. Who knows? If Rangers win it and they get into the Champions League next year and they get all the money and they build on that and they can build an even stronger squad and they widen the gap, unless Ange improves, then it's not looking good, I think, in that situation. So it's not a time to be taking gambles like this, is what a lot of people think, and that's why they wanted the kind of trusted name. So they've not got a safe choice. They've got a gamble, and it could pay off. It could be a brilliant gamble. It could be they don't have to spend the money in the manager. You spend the money in the players, Angie will come in, and if he does well, I'm sure he'll get money later on. But it doesn't have to be paid as much as a VS Boas. or, you know, a Zidane. But he doesn't have the Real Madrid name. So I think he's got that going for him, and he might be on a 1 year contract or something. That kind of situation, which Neil Lennon was on a 1 year rolling contract. So I mean, that's interesting to see how that'll affect him if it is a contract of that length, and how he'll play or adapt to that situation. But it's a gamble they've taken, and some people are not happy about the gamble, unfortunately. I am, now that I've thought about it, and I'm interested to see how it goes.
Good stuff. Yeah, you might have talked yourself around in the course of this this podcast recording, Sean. So, yeah, that's a really thoughtful answer, and we very much appreciate it. There was a question from Nawia about the Celtic fans' reaction, and also the first part of Akaki Chino 11's email question was about that as well. So, yeah, hopefully, guys, Sean's answered that well there. And, well, Sean, I mean, it's good to know that there are at least a few. You've come across a few Celtic supporters still having an open mind, and yeah, hopefully they've also clicked onto this podcast and have heard you speak about Ange, and yeah, maybe they can spread the word amongst their Celtic supporting friends about what is possible under Ange Postecoglou. There are sure to be growing pains, but you've obviously experienced a glorious time under him during for that 2019 season that, as we said earlier, will be ever with a one star on your kit, and as you said yourself, nobody can take that away from the team and from Ange himself. So I guess as we kind of try to wrap things up here, and whether we've answered the what comes next for F. Marino's questions is up for debate, but yeah, we simply don't know what sort of direction they might go, and if an Ange. An Ange disciple is available, then as Sam mentioned, John Hutchinson, then for me that might be the best stopgap until the end of the season, when the front office can reassess. But I guess as we wind things down, there was a question from Johnny Nicol, and he'd like both of you to answer, of course, Sam, from a neutral perspective. Johnny asks, if Ange has taken charge of a Marino's game for the last time, how will history judge his reign? Results-wise, there's been one amazing season and two mediocre ones, albeit with big caveats, obviously his first season, and then last season the coronavirus hit campaign. And this year it's obviously a bit too early to say how things stand, but you are a strong third in the table, Sean. So, Sam, why don't you go first then? From a neutral perspective, how will the history judge Ange Postecoglou's time at Yokohama F. Marinos?
Oh, I think it'll absolutely be a success. That 2019 season, the football that was played to go on and win the league in the manner that they did, I think, it was one of the better title wins that I've seen in my few years watching the J-League. And I think just the general, as I mentioned earlier, the way that he's kind of brought in this new philosophy to the league, it's kind of had such an impact across various different clubs. I said Kawasaki earlier. I think it's helped like a team like Red to look for a manager like Rodriguez to play that sort of style, and I just think it's going to benefit the rest of the league going forward. I think he's kind of shown that you can have a lot of success playing a really expansive brand of football. So I think it's been fantastic. The first season, obviously, the teething pains. Then last season, coronavirus did absolutely take them apart a little bit. And so I think you can forgive those two seasons. And this year, after a really poor start in the first two games, he has tweaked the tactics slightly. He has then shown that he can adapt to that situation. And Marinos have been a very good team. I mean, they're still away from Kawasaki, but they're, in my opinion, the comfortable second best team in the league at the moment. So, I think he's just, that team is a team that everyone wants to watch. They have been the biggest thing that we've spoken about on this podcast for 3 or 4 years now, just because everyone wants to see a Postecoglou team. And I think, that is how he'll be remembered, as a manager that has been brought such excitement to the league. So, it will only be positive, and I don't think there'll be too much of the negative, as much as I will remember Hiroki Ikaru's moseying out from goal in that first season.
Yes, indeed. So, I mean, you said it yourself, Sean. He'll always be an F. Marino's legend, no matter what happens at Celtic. But, yeah, in relation to Johnny's question, you definitely did have to take the rough with the smooth, though, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, that's football, right? You can't appreciate the good times if you're not there at the bad times. There were some bad times in that first season. There were some hand-in-head moments. There were some worries that we're going down to J2, get the flight to Okinawa booked, I think, we're thinking. But, you wouldn't trade anything for winning the league that season in the way that we won it, and especially just the last few games, the away game at Todoroki, just absolutely dominated that and put us in the position that we took it to the last game as the favourites and just had to not lose. And not only did that, but entertained on the last game as well. And that just summed up the season. And who knows if we'll ever see that again. And the biggest compliment that people can pay to Ange is that that's been noticed. And he's got this offer from Celtic, is what we believe. And when's the last time that a J-League manager has been plucked from during the season to go and manage in Europe? I mean, you think about Arsene Wenger, that's the kind of level we're talking about, right? And so I think he'll be remembered very, very fondly in Marino's. And you got to take the context as well. The other two seasons, like you said, growing pains in the first season, but some entertaining football. He would have been remembered in a different way if that was his only season, but as an entertaining season. And then last season, right, Corona, and people might roll their eyes if I say this, but I think probably the way that Marino's play were the most probably affected by the schedule of last season. And Andrew said himself that he takes full responsibility for rotating the team too much because of how many games there were playing twice a week. And they just couldn't get into the rhythm of it. And he hasn't done that this year. He's learned from that and he's played more kind of solid teams. And it's worked a lot better. So I think that overall, I mean, winning the league can't be beat. 15 years big is a long time to not do it. When you expect to win the league, and a lot of people who are Marino supporters, they do expect Marino's to be up there. And yeah, and returned Marino's to the top. And who knows when that'll happen again? So we're living in good times. Maybe if Frontaglio were slightly weaker, it'd be better times. But I think, yeah, it's been a brilliant experience watching Ange's Marino's, and I don't think anyone will forget it anytime soon.
All right, thanks for that, Sean. And yeah, no questions asked. Always an F. Marino's legend, as you say. No matter what happens at Celtic Park, if it does go ahead. Now, guys, I'm obviously from Australia, obviously a betting mad country as well. Do the UK bookmakers ever get it wrong, spectacularly wrong, when a candidate is this much of a short price favourite? I mean, we are to assume, and I mean, Scott McIntyre's tweeted about it, so we basically have to assume it's going ahead in that regard. But I mean, yeah, is there? Can you see any way at all, Sam, that this doesn't happen as we say, as we record on Monday night, Japan time, but nothing is official as of yet?
I mean, I'd be surprised. It's at 1-10 on at the moment, but I didn't check the market for Eddie Howe, because I imagine he'd be quite short odds as well, and that did fall apart, so you never know with this. But I mean, the way it is at the moment, it looks pretty much set that Postecoglou will take over.
If I can just jump in with one point there, I think that there's been some kind of interesting talk, I think, about licenses held by Ange, and the idea that you need a UEFA pro license to manage in Europe, and that he doesn't have. And I think even the Times in London actually reported on this, and it's a kind of grey area apparently. And I think that you need to be either some certain amount of way through a course to do it, and some people kind of been digging and thinking maybe he doesn't have these badges. But you'd hope that Celtic had done the research. And I think it was actually Kevin Muscat went to Belgium or something like that, and he didn't have the requisite badges either, so they created a technical director position for him that was he was not the coach, but he was coaching. So, yeah, I mean, I think you'd think they'd probably thought it through, but, I mean, that could be one last banana skin on the way there. So I've got a bit more faith in the people that are deciding this than that, but hopefully they've got it right, and this is just a bit of a rumour.
Yeah, well, just across Glasgow, Stephen Gerrard didn't have his pro licence when he took over at Rangers. So I think as long as you have a coach on your staff that does have the licence, then you're okay, and then he'll just complete it as and when over the course of the year. But, I mean, I've seen various things on Twitter. Some say that he does hold the licence, some don't. So I think it's a little bit of an unknown. But as you say, I'm sure they've done all their due diligence and know that if they want Postecoglou, he can probably come in and take the job.
Well, yeah, interesting there. Some Celtic supporters are obviously really against this appointment, going through the fine print of the UEFA regulations there to try and find any way they can stop Postecoglou taking over, by the sounds of it. But, yeah, it does look like it's going to happen. A huge opportunity for Ange Postecoglou. Obviously, mixed emotions, as Kenji said and as Sean said throughout this episode, for all F. Marino supporters. But, yeah, I'm sure they wish Ange the best, as we say, if it does go ahead. And what can we say, Sean? Well, it's been a long time between podcast appearances for you, but yeah, what a barnstorming return it was. Yeah, this was obviously right in your wheelhouse, the two clubs that you support and you love more than any other. So we very much appreciate your thoughtful answers to all of our questions from our patrons, and your thoughts on this whole situation, which, as we say, it must be very bittersweet for you with the manager of one of your favourite teams going to join the other. So we very much appreciate it, and let's just hope this all works out for the best, eh?
Yeah. Thanks again for having me, Ben. I mean, it's just again. Still, I still can't believe that it's happened, and it feels like a dream, but I'm not sure if it's a nightmare or a dream, but it's happening, and it's probably something that won't happen again to me, so it's good to be here in that moment to share it with all of you. But hopefully, yeah, we'll have more exciting times ahead for both Celtic and Marinos, and we'll have some more good things to talk about, because, yeah, I mean, well, Angie might leave, the show goes on, right? And we've still got a lot of games to go, so still an exciting season ahead, still looking forward to it. I'll still be at every game.
All right, well, that is absolutely sensational. Our thanks to Sean Galbraith. And where do we go from there, Sam? Well, we better wrap up what happened on the pitch over the weekend in J1 Matchday 17. So after a quick hit of music, we'll be back to do just that. All right, welcome back. Absolutely phenomenal stuff from Sean there all the way through part one. Let's move on to what happened on the pitch in J1 Matchday 17. And, Sean's team, Yokohama F. Marinos, are one of the few teams in J1 to win in both the last midweek and indeed over the weekend. They moved up to third in midweek. With that win, they finally were able to dislodge the parked bus of Oita, and then on Sunday they returned to Nissan Stadium to face Shimizu, Sam, and again it took a late winner, but F. Marinos were ultimately able to triumph for 2-1 over Shimizu S-Pulse.
Yeah, it was a fairly similar game, especially when it went to 1-1, where Shimizu were just sat really deep. They were relying on Santana and Carlinhos to counter-attack for anything, but generally it was just men behind the ball trying to frustrate Yokohama, and it took them up until the 89th minute, and they finally managed it with Mizunuma making a little bit of space for himself on the right and finding Leo Sierra with a good striker's finish. But it was probably just reward for Yokohama, who had all of the possession as always, but Shimizu defended very well. The two up front, they did cause problems, but then Lottino decided to sub them both for no logical reason, and then they had no outlet, and eventually the pressure told off, and it was, yeah, in the end, a deserved 2-1 victory for Yokohama.
Yeah, so Elber had given F. Marinos a fourth-minute lead, and then 4 minutes before half-time, Thiago Santana equalised for S-Pulse before Leo Ciara's late winner. And there was also a late drama at Todoroki, where defending champions and, again, runaway leaders Kawasaki Looked to bounce back from being held to a one-all draw in midweek at Shawnun, and it took until the 94th minute for them to win, to also 2-1 at home, Sam, over Kashima Antlers. Kobayashi ultimately scoring the winner, with Kashima players appealing for offside and not realising at first that the cross from Tatsuya Hasegawa had been deflected into Kobayashi's path by their own defender, Corky Machida.
Yeah, I don't know if we have a cheering version of the VAR jingle, but it might need to be broke out for this game because, yeah, it got that decision absolutely spot on. It also got the decision to flag Weather offside for his goal overturned. So, yeah, perfect from VAR. Not always the case this season, but I thought this was a really good game. Kawasaki were dominant first half, deserved their 1-0 lead. They were up for it a lot more than we've seen in recent games against, let's say, lesser opposition, where they have looked a touch complacent. This game, they were right on it. But Kashima came back second half, and after they'd equalised, they were looking like the team that would go on and win the game and maybe be the first to beat Kawasaki this season. But, yeah, Kobayashi stepped up at the end, and Kawasaki don't know that the game's over until it's over, and they managed to get a vital 3 points just to sort of arrest a little bit of a mini slump. But yeah, really important for them. And yeah, but it was a tough result on Kashima.
Yes, indeed. Antlers had moved up to sixth in midweek, but slipped back down to eighth after that game on Sunday. Next to the second place, Nagoya Grampus. But Sam, they might not be second for too much longer. They're now three without a win. They had lost sensationally in midweek to Sendai, and then on Sunday they travelled to Saitama Stadium and seemed to have the better of things from the highlights, but were unable to break down Urawa Reds. The game finishing 0-0. Seemingly the best chance came at 10 minutes from time, but Grampus sub Manabu Saito's shot came back off the post. So, yeah, Nagoya can forget about chasing down Kawasaki. They're now very much looking over their shoulders at F. Marinos and even Tosu, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. And this was just kind of a typical Nagoya performance, in that we've said it all over this season that they don't have the firepower up front to score goals in tight games. They did, as you said, they were the better team the first half. They controlled much of the game, but a couple of chances fell their way. But Kakitani hooked over. There was one where Yamasaki left Iwanami for dead, but then just rushed his shot. And you just think, if there's a clinical striker in that team, they'd be winning far more games. But they couldn't break Reds down. Reds, I thought, were really poor in the first half. And again, it's maybe just repeating myself, but he keeps tinkering with that team. Again, he was dropping Koizumi from the number 10 role back into a deeper midfield role, and they completely lost the battle to Nagoya in that first half because of that. Finally, they got a little bit of a foothold in the second half when they made that half-time change, but it's often is reacting too late to poor decisions in his starting lineup, and this is not the first time that they've had a really poor first half. They did get it back, but that second half was pretty dull as well. So, yeah, 0-0 was a suitable scoreline for this game.
Yeah, fair enough then. I think I might have said earlier that F. Marinos moved up to third in midweek, but in apologies, they did so over the weekend after their win at home against Shimizu. And yeah, Tosu dropping points away at Kobe in another draw, a one-all draw on this occasion. For Tosu, Keiya Sento took a pass from Yoshihiro Nakano and blasted home at Daya Maekawa's near post to give Tosu the lead after just 43 seconds. But Douglas pounced on a dreadful error from a Tosu keeper, Park Il-gyu, hearkening back to his F. Marinos days, perhaps, to volley into an unguarded net in the 28th minute. There were chances at either end in the second half, Sam, but ultimately, yeah, as I say, it ended 1-1, and that saw Tosu slip down to fourth spot.
Yeah, it was a fairly even game. Tosu started, as you said, very brightly in getting that goal. Kobe were a little all over the place. All their team had been dragged over to the one side, and Tosu moved it quickly and got it out to centre, and he scored. But Kobe did get their foot back into the game. They controlled possession. They were at least in this game, they had Sam Pair back in midfield, and he was going for those balls over the top, and first Gokay got free, and he had a shot wide, and then it results in the goal, where there's a bit of indecision from Park. It then challenges Furuhashi, it goes straight to Douglas. So at least they were showing that sort of positivity to get to 1-1, but then they kind of went back into their ways of just playing slowly sideways football, and Kobe's form in recent weeks, and maybe the last 6 weeks, has been very patchy, and it's because they've gone away from the kind of more direct attacking style that they started the season with. But I suppose with the way that Tosu have been playing this season, a 1-1 draw is not a bad result, but yeah, I think both teams will think they could have got a bit more out of it.
All right, next to Fukuoka, who stayed fifth in the table, but maybe came back to reality a little bit, Sam, over the course of the past week. They saw their six-game winning run snapped in midweek away at bottom club Yokohama FC when they drew 1-1. And then on Sunday, they travelled just the short trip over to Oita for a Kyushu derby, and slipped to a 2-1 defeat. And my question to you, Sam, is who was that masked man that gave Oita a seventh-minute lead?
Oh, don't talk. He's come back to bite me. I mean, it's because last week I said that Avispa have got Yokohama and Oita, and yeah, their winning run will probably continue because they're quite comfortable games. So obviously, Mr. Nagasawa has to turn up and throw that in my face and come and score after 7 minutes, but it's a reasonable goal for him, I suppose. He's tucked it away fairly nicely. But yeah, I apologise to all the Avispa fans for the previous two results. It's definitely all my fault. But again, I thought they played poorly in midweek, and I thought they were poor in this game as well. I mean, Oita, they've not been a great side all season, but they got in front early on, and really they dealt with what Avispa threw at them, because it's a lot of set piece, it's a lot of crosses into the box, but Oita defensively were very solid. They held on, they went and then got the second goal, which was crucial to them, and even though they got it back to 2-1 Avispa, Oita again were still fairly comfortable with that, and yeah, they were one of the very few teams that have managed to kind of keep Avispa at bay. So full credit to Oita. It's really making the relegation battle a lot more interesting now than it looked maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago, where we've got now just teams level on points with the safe positions in 16th. So that's really exciting. So full credit to them. But yeah, Avispa just kind of need to reassess, I think, for the way they've approached the last two games, because they didn't look threatening in either of them.
Yes, maybe this international break has come at the right time for Avispa. As you say, Sam, they can reset and have a think about things. These past two results, certainly not up to scratch on the standards they'd set in the previous six-game winning run, and yeah, basically throughout the season so far. But yeah, a huge win for Oita, as you say. A first win in five for them, and just the third all season as they look to hang on to the coattails of the teams just outside the relegation zone. Oita are still bottom at the international break, but just 2 points from safety after this win. Shun Nagasawa, as we say, a seventh-minute goal to put them into the lead, and then centre-back Henrique Trevisan, with his first J-League goal with 20 minutes left, gave Trinita a two-goal cushion, though Jordi Crooks set up a nervous finale for the home faithful at the Oita Dome with his 77th minute penalty. But yes, Oita hung on, and fair play to them as Fukuoka reassess over this international break. Next to a game...
You said Oita were bottom, and Yokohama FC are a poor side, but you can't get rid of them just this early.
Sorry, I was intending to say second from bottom, but I don't... Sorry, Oita and all your supporters, but... Yes, most definitely second from bottom, and yes, 2 points from safety. Next to a game we can literally spend 10 seconds on, Sam, FC Tokyo 0, Hiroshima 0 at Ajinomoto Stadium. Kensuke Nagai shot against the bar 10 seconds into the second half, and Tsukasa Morishima dragged his shot wide in second half stoppage time, and apart from that, nothing else happened.
Yeah, absolute dross. Next.
Sounds good to me. All right, let's move on to another draw. Quite a few of them in the match day. But another positive result, Sam, for Vegalta Sendai. They followed on from their huge win away at Nagoya in midweek with another creditable point, this time at home against Cerezo Osaka. Although, I don't know, the form that Cerezo are in, now six without a win, should Sendai have actually been winning this game?
Maybe. The way they were playing, they did play very well. But although I thought Cerezo had good chances as well, there were times in this game where Jakub Slovic, as he is wont to do, pulled out some fantastic saves. There was one, I think it was a Thiago header that he got down too well and was right back up for an Okubo rebound. And it's just, yeah, you'd Sendai need him to do that quite a lot of the time to get results. But going the other way, I thought Sendai, they've improved a lot, as we've mentioned, I think, last week. And they've come in, they've been... Nishimura has offered a lot more going forward. Sekiguchi coming in has added a little bit of experience in there. And the youngster Kato has kind of been revitalised, I think, with having Sekiguchi there. Foginho in midfield is offering a lot more protection to that back line that was being cut apart at the start of the season. So generally, there is a lot of improvement in this Sendai team. And they played very well in midweek to get their 1-0 victory, and they did so here to get back at 1-0. Martinez with the goal. I don't know if you've seen his post-match interview where he says, it was good that I scored the goal, but maybe if the coach had actually started me, we might win some games. That was quite interesting and not translated particularly accurately by the translator there. But I thought, yeah, he has done very well, not got enough starts, as he says. But, yeah, generally, Sendai played very well. Cerezo, like, Taggart started this game, but he still doesn't look anywhere near match sharp. I mean, he's got into the national team, so hopefully for Cerezo's sake, he can build a bit more fitness there. But yeah, they're not creating too much. They got their goal from a set piece, but it's not good enough, I don't think. And yeah, they started off quite well, but I think they've drifted into this kind of malaise at the moment. And yeah, we were worried, I thought, at the start of the season about the way that Kulpi would manage this team, and at the moment it's only going one way, and that's down the table.
Yeah, most definitely. They've slid down to 10th now, as we say, six without a win, and worrying signs, I think, for Cerezo and their supporters, as results are looking very, very flat. But the same cannot be said for Sendai, who have done a terrific job in the last month or so. Just one loss in their last five games, and that includes a draw away at the champions Kawasaki, and indeed a win in midweek away at the currently second-placed Nagoya. So, full credit to Sendai. A lot of us had written them off, well, at the start of the season in my case, but then, after they'd made a very stuttering start to the season. But they've enjoyed a good month, and they'll hope to return from the international break and to, carry on the positive vibes. All right, well, we're holstering the jingle, aren't we, this week, Sam? And we've mentioned that VAR was had some very positive interventions in the Kawasaki versus Kashima game. But VAR was very much front and centre, especially in the first half at Hitachidai in the only game played on Saturday when Kashiwa hosted Consadole Sapporo. It's also ultimately ended up 2-1 to the visitors, but in a first half that might still nearly be going with all those VAR reviews that took place and how long it took to ultimately arrive at what looked like fairly simple decisions. It was a lot of talking points, especially, as we say, from the first half of that game that Sapporo ended up winning.
Yeah, this was VAR at its worst. I mean, they've got the decisions right, which is at least that's one thing. But goodness me, especially the second Sapporo goal, the Aoki goal, he's so far onside. It's a country mile on. And he takes 4 minutes to make the decision. It should take 4 seconds. It's just, what is going on with them? And so we had like 10 minutes of added time. It wasn't much better for the penalty that Aoki conceded for Takahashi. He's definitely got caught the wrong side. He's definitely brought him down. So again, I don't know why it lasted quite as long as it did. But I mean, at least the decisions were right. But it's just really frustrating, I'm sure, for everyone watching, everyone in the ground who probably didn't really know what was going on. So, it's not, hopefully, well, we say that all the time, but hopefully this is just the exception, not what is going to happen constantly with VAR. But, this was a little bit farcical, I thought, especially the second one.
Yeah, no question. All right, so Tsuyoshi Ogashiwa put Sapporo into a 19th minute lead. Then Cristiano fired Reysel Level from the penalty spot after the first of the lengthy VAR reviews that found that Ryota Aoki had upended Shunki Takahashi. 5 minutes later, Daihachi Okamura's deflected shot crept in at Kim Sung-gyu's near post. But yes, the goal wasn't confirmed until 4 minutes later. I don't know, Sam. I think the flag went up against Jay Bothroyd, right, who was offside, but there was no way he was interfering with play. So that's the only explanation I can see, that the linesman perhaps thought Bothroyd was closer to the ball and maybe impeding a defender from going to make a challenge on Okamura or something like that. That's the only logical explanation I can think of, but still, it's no real reason why it should take 4 minutes. But so basically, I don't know whether the team's completely knackered after playing 10 minutes of stoppage time in the first half and not a lot happened in the second half, or did Reysel ever really threaten to fashion a second equaliser?
Yeah, they did have it was quite an open game, I thought, as it usually is with Sapporo, and probably when these two teams get together, it's usually open. So they had occasional chances. Hosoya had one shot that was pretty easily saved, and there was one right towards the end where the ball just bounces and it falls to the wrong person. It fell to Kamajima, who had an effort from about 6 yards but didn't really catch it right and put it wide. So, and actually, it was probably Sapporo had the best chance to go and make it 3-1 where Bothroyd played in Aoki, and I mean, it was just a terrible shot. He was straight in on goal and put it well wide. So maybe, yeah, I think Sapporo probably did edge it. I thought they were the better team in the first half, and Kashua didn't quite create enough really to get back into it. But it was a pretty decent game.
Good stuff then. All right, so yeah, an away win for Sapporo. And, well, just two games left, Sam. We're making record-breaking progress here through this this J1 fixture list. But, two games to go. The first one is we'll cover is yet another draw. Tokushima hosted Shonan, and they took a 13th-minute lead through Kaka, a diving header from 6 yards that I'm sure was very aesthetically pleasing for you, Sam. But 10 minutes later, Shonan were level. A bit of a horror show from the Tokushima defender Dusan, and Shuto Machino equalised for Shonan after Dusan needlessly went to ground and failed to clear the ball outside the box. And that wrapped up a fairly successful week, you'd have to say, for Shonan, Sam, after holding the champions to a 1-1 draw at home and then travelling away to Tokushima and repeating the result. That's reasonably satisfactory week's work for Belmare, I'd say.
Yeah, they'd absolutely take it. It's kind of been the way their season has gone. They've been very, very tough to beat. They haven't always scored too many goals. They can't blow any teams away, but they keep everything tight. I mean, they got back into this with thanks to a horrendous piece of defending from Dusan. It's one of the worst things I've seen. It's just a long ball upfield, and what he's doing, he just kind of falls over rather than making a tackle. It's just pretty pathetic defending, but yeah, I think Shonan, the rest of the game was really dull, and no one really created anything. I think both teams are in that kind of position outside of the relegation zone where they don't really want to risk anything in case they get dragged into it, and they were both seemed quite content with the point, I thought. But for Shonan, especially in midweek, I thought they were very good against Kawasaki. They took the game to them, especially at the start of the second half, and really deserved the point at least. They were unfortunate. It took an absolute wonder goal from Leandro Damian to bring that level. But yeah, it's been a really positive season so far, I thought, for Shonan, because I had them a little bit low. I thought they were good relegation candidates, but they have just been really, they've battled really hard. They've outworked a lot of the other teams down there, and they're getting rewards for that. But it's just, how long can you continue doing that without necessarily having that out-and-out goal scorer that's going to get you enough goals to win games? Because, yeah, there are going to be times, I think, where they just run out of steam a little bit and don't have that, they can't have that nick a goal and win a game 1-0. So that would worry me slightly, but so far, yeah, it's been a very positive season for them.
All right, then. And so to the last game, and it's between teams who began and finished the match day in 18th and 20th in the table. But what it is, Sam, is it's finished off a hugely important week for Fagumba Osaka, who won for the first time in 8 games, wasn't it, at 2-1 at home over Tokushima in midweek, and then won again at home over a bottom place Yokohama FC, 2-0 on Sunday, thanks to a brace from Leandro Pereira. You said it yourself last week on the pod, and indeed in your Patreon match day review of the midweek action. This was a key week for Fagumba, and indeed the game came up on Wednesday is another part of it. That they needed to start to pick up results to turn things around, and 2 wins in a week. Although I'm not sure how great the performances were at this stage. Any result is a result for Gumba, and they'll most definitely take the 6 points from those 2 games.
Yeah, the performances don't matter at all. They've got the points. I thought they've played pretty poorly in both games. I think they, thankfully, I think for Matsunami, he's ditched kind of attacking style he tried to bring in against Urara and got cut to pieces. And it's gone completely the other way. They've played 5 at the back against Tokushima and against Yokohama. In that Tokushima game, they were so defensive, and Tokushima had the ball for large parts of the game and were very unfortunate to come away with a loss in that one. And Gamba got a little bit fortunate. And then in this game, I thought Yokohama for large parts were the better team. I didn't think Gamba played too well at all. They got a penalty, which I think is so soft. Mm. Like Majima strokes the back of Tsukamoto at most, and then a penalty is awarded for that, which I thought was a little bit fortunate. Gamba then took a little bit from that. I thought Pereira then had a bit more confidence going forward, and he took his goal in the second half well. But still, I thought that there were chances for Yokohama FC. There was that real one where Higashiguchi tips onto the post, and then Ogawa has to score the rebound and doesn't. And I think against any side better than Yokohama FC, Gamba would have at least drawn that game, if not lost it. So I think there's still a lot of work to do at Gamba, but the most important thing is they've got those 6 points. If they then go on to win in midweek, it takes them out of the relegation zone, which will be massive psychologically for them. So yeah, they'll take the 6 points and move on. But I hope they don't look at these 2 games, look at the 2 results and think, yeah, Matsunami is definitely the manager to take us forward, because the performance-wise, I think they've been really poor still.
Yeah, that's right. So the results at this stage are all they care about. But yeah, they're going to have to turn things around after the international break. Before that, though, yeah, they do have the small matter of a trip to Shonan on Wednesday night in a game brought forward from match day 19. Also on Wednesday, it'll be bottom hosting top when the Yokohama FC entertain Kawasaki in a game brought forward from match day 21, and that's obviously with the ACL in mind. Then there are no more J1 games until Saturday the 19th, when we'll have 6 games to complete a match day 18. Obviously, the ACL teams have already played their fixtures for that round, I believe, or they're to be scheduled the later on. But there's no more J1 action on the weekend until the weekend of the 19th and the 20th. So we'll leave it there. I think Sam, just with a very brief mention, of course, of the Japan national team, who beat Myanmar 10-0 last Friday night at the Fukuda Denchi Arena in Chiba. Yuya Osako scored 5 and Takumi Minamino scored 2 for a Japan national team who outshot their visitors 27-2 and enjoyed 77% of the possession, as you might expect in a game like that. Most importantly for Japan, they sealed the qualification through to the final round of Asian World Cup qualification. And then, coming up, Sam, Japan play Jamaica in a friendly at the Sapporo Dome on Thursday. And then next Monday, they host Tajikistan in a World Cup qualifier at Suita, with obviously Japan's progress to the next round already decided. So, I don't know, is it worth even mentioning the Myanmar game? We knew it was going to be a procession similar to the one against Mongolia in the last international break. I guess it's worth mentioning the political situation in Myanmar, and it was obviously a very difficult situation for the Myanmar players, and with the protests outside the stadium from some Myanmar nationals in Japan about the political situation there.
Yeah, it's a really difficult situation because I believe most of the team, anyone based outside of Myanmar, didn't turn up for this game, and kind of they're only the ones that were there were the players that were forced to represent the country that were already in Myanmar. So yeah, it's a really tough situation they had to go through. The game becomes kind of meaningless after that because they're going through a lot. They've not been able to bring their best team. Japan just, they dealt with it professionally, but I mean, what do you get really out of a Japan 10-0 victory over Myanmar reserves? I mean, yeah, credit to the players from Myanmar that turned up, that played their hearts out. They, yeah, never didn't give up. But, yeah, it was just a pretty comfortable victory for Japan. At least they've got qualification to the next round sorted. It was always going to happen. But there are much more important games coming up for Japan in this next section of the qualifying rounds.
Yeah, most definitely. Of course, that was an entirely overseas-based squad of players for the game last Friday, and then the domestic players will be filtered into the team for the next couple of games. And obviously, it's a busy international period, as we said, with the no more J1 on the weekend until Saturday, the 19th. All right. Well, that was. Quite a bumper episode, Sam, but there, as we said at the start, there's been hardly any bigger story in the J-League in recent years. So Ange Postecoglou to Celtic was most definitely worth spending a great deal of time on. And we greatly appreciate Sean Galbraith's contribution to the pod, and of course all the questions from our patrons as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a fantastic guest, answered all our questions. Yeah, very well. It was great to have that sort of perspective on the podcast from both camps. So hopefully this does go through and it's not revealed just after we post the pod that he's turned it down or anything like that. So, but yeah, thanks to him and thanks to all the patrons for all their questions.
Indeed. Well, yeah, of course, Ange did play a very straight bat to Dan Orlowitz's question after the Yokohama F. Marinos Shimizu game on Sunday. Obviously, not giving anything away at all about his intentions, but yeah, we'll wait to see how things develop in the coming days. So yeah, once again, we'd like to thank all of our patrons who submitted questions for this week's episode. Daniel, Johnny, Akakichino 11, Kenji, Tokyo Fox, Khalil, Naoya, Michael, and Charlotte. And obviously to all of our patrons for their ongoing support, and especially to those who have signed up in May. Our new true believers are Chris, Wataru, Harry, Rishi, and Sean, and I'm not sure if I mentioned Stephen, who signed up at the end of April, but if I didn't, Stephen, there you go, you got a mention, and if I did, well, there's a second one for you. So, that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I haven't actually talked about what we're going to do about our podcast next week with just the internationals going on. We'll let you know on Twitter at JTalkPod. Speak to you again soon. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.